This episode is brought to you by Progressive, America's number one motorcycle insurer. Everything is more exhilarating when you're on your motorcycle, just like your bike is more protected when you choose Progressive Motorcycle Insurance. They offer coverage for your bike starting as low as $75 per year, and they keep things affordable with discounts like paid in full, multi-policy, and responsible driver. So raise your kickstands and get to quoting at Progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. $75 premium is for state minimum coverage. Not available in D.C. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
It's Tuesday, April 9th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca, and let us play Embassy Roulette. First up, Ecuador. You remember the Ecuadorian embassy in London is the long-term temporary headquarters of this fella.
A rare look inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where Julian Assange lived for almost 7 years.
Julian Assange was ejected, and that request came from the Ecuadorians.
His political asylum granted by Ecuador only protected him inside these walls, but outside, British soil and the potential for arrest. That happened on Thursday. Looking frail, the 47-year-old was dragged from the building by British police. Amid reports, he left his small space filthy.
I can't confirm, but a grown man living in a small room for 6 years might just have left it in a state of quote-unquote filth. Now, the Ecuadorians have embassy issues of their own, as Mexico has granted asylum to one of Ecuador's former officials. Arrested was Jorge Glass, Ecuador's former vice president. Glass was arrested last Friday. He had been convicted in the past on charges of bribery and corruption and remains under investigation for other potential crimes. Mexico wanted Ecuador to honor the commitment to the sovereignty of their embassy. They had granted Glass asylum as subject of political persecution. Ecuador didn't buy it. They regarded the former VP's claims of innocence as glass half empty. Given his previous convictions, he is to them a bit of a stained glass. Ecuador's right-leaning president, Daniel Noboa, is facing a tough re-election and publicly punishing a symbol of corruption who is affiliated with his political rivals, that to him is an appealing political gesture. Noboa's calculus goes, Ecuador is genuinely in a state of emergency because of public corruption. Punishing the former president addresses that. In case of emergency, break glass. Mexico President Andrés Manuel López Obrador tore into his Ecuadorian peer, saying, when there are weak governments that do not have popular support or capacity, those who do not have experience come. Manuel López Obrador, by the way, is himself a champion of rooting out corruption. But recently, a couple months ago, ProPublica reported that he accepted drug traffickers' combined $2 million in contributions to his first unsuccessful presidential campaign, leading one to conclude that perhaps the people who housed Glass shouldn't throw stones. On the show today, I shall speak about an Alabama ruling for the record books and from the history books. But first, we pick back up where we left off yesterday with Keith Humphreys, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University, co-author of a recent feature for The Atlantic magazine, Why Oregon's Drug Decriminalization Failed. And we will get into that and into more of that about Oregon and its failed Measure 110. Keith Humphreys, part two, up next. Controversial statement upcoming about foodies. You know the best part about being a foodie? It's the food. And you know the worst part? Well, I'm not going to say everything else. The restaurant experience is often really quite good, but so often it's not. Getting the reservation and then cramming into a cramped table and then paying, it's often very expensive. And here's this trend. You know, tile looks cool on the floor often and brick on the wall, but then when you combine that in a crowded restaurant, it is hard to enjoy dinner above the din. What about the cooking? What about the food? Well, I give you Cook Unity. It's the first chef-to-you service that delivers locally sourced meals from award-winning chefs right to your door every week. Choose between 4 and 16 meals. You can just give your life over to Cook Unity, or just pick and choose their delicious meals from award-winning chefs. A chef collective bringing exciting culinary talent straight to your table. It's sometimes hard to find out who are the up-and-coming chefs. Cook Unity has collected many of them, and they give you 7 different dietary preferences: vegan, paleo, pescatarian, gluten-free, and then you can tell them, I don't like soy, I don't like nuts, or can't have them, and you don't have them. They post the menus 2 weeks in advance. It's fun to go and look over the menu. I've been enjoying so many of the meals from Cook Unity. I had a Korean beef dish that was amazing. I had a quinoa and salmon with the string beans that was likewise amazing. Couldn't be easier to make. They don't give it to you frozen. They give it to you in packaging that could last in the fridge up to 7 days. I've tested them on that, and it has worked. It was delicious. So experience chef-quality meals every week delivered right to your door. Go to cookunity.com/thegist or enter code thegist before checkout for 50% off your first week. That is 50% off your first week by using the code THEGIST or going to cookunity.com/THEGIST.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive, America's number one motorcycle insurer. Everything is more exhilarating when you're on your motorcycle. Just like your bike is more protected when you choose Progressive Motorcycle Insurance. They offer coverage for your bike starting as low as $75 per year. And they keep things affordable with discounts like paid in full, multi-policy, and responsible driver. So raise your kickstands and get to quoting at Progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. $75 premium is for state minimum coverage. Not available in D.C. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Keaton Preece is a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford. And when we spoke yesterday, we talked about Oregon Measure 110 and voting that decriminalization law out. It was a failure. People were dying. There were people shooting up in the streets. Now, I spoke to, you may have heard in part one, the professor saying most people aren't driven by a study. There are certain beliefs and policies that can't be shaken by data. But there was a very widely cited study that seemed to support this experiment as a success. Corey Davis and others at the NYU Grossman School of Medicine found there was no evidence that Measure 110 was associated with any change in fatal drug overdose rates in Oregon. To remind you of just how big an increase the fatal drug overdoses were, Measure 110 passes in 2021. Between September 22 and September 23, overdose deaths rise 42%, the highest increase in the country. The fatality rate nationwide in this time of fentanyl, 2%. Now, a month and a half ago, the Oregonian pulled back a little more, widened the aperture, and they reported that the yearly fentanyl overdose deaths in Oregon grew by an estimated 1,500% since before the pandemic, quote, by far the largest increase in the United States federal data show. But still, this one study was being widely cited. In fact, NYU put out a press release linking to many, many articles, and I'll read some of them and some of the headlines. This press release went out in 2023, so that was when the death toll was only up 42%. Time magazine, decriminalizing drug possession doesn't lead to more fatal overdoses. Newsweek, scientists confirm decriminalizing drugs doesn't increase overdose deaths. The Daily Mail, the Seattle Times, and on and on and on and on. So, I put it to an actual professor, a researcher, someone who says he knows Keith Humphreys, who was the author, main author of that study, pretty well. How could that be? How could that study stand for so long and be cited so often when the facts are just contradicting it left and right? The question was the study accurate at the time it was published?
Yeah, so there were two studies that came out. First off, they both looked at the first year only.
Yes.
And now we're much further into it with a much higher overdose rate. Second, the two studies, one was an economic study and one was this health study. They both showed an increase. It's just that in the study with that was published in JAMA Psychiatry, it wasn't statistically significant, and it was in the other. So I didn't think they were as different as was portrayed. And a point made in that study, by the way, which is true, is fentanyl is a game changer. So, you know, California, we got hit by fentanyl too. Our overdose death rates are up also. But the difference is ours are up 5%, not 45%.
Yeah.
Idaho is right next to those states. It's up about 5 or 6%, but it's not up 45%. The only state that it looks like it at all is Washington State, which also just went through a big decriminalization binge. So it's hard to explain it and just say it's just the arrival of fentanyl, which is the argument people would make.
That's right. There's there was a national single-digit increase in opioid deaths because of fentanyl, and this wasn't distributed evenly across the states in America. But Oregon and Washington had 40-something percent increases, while the country as a whole was in the low single digits.
Yeah, and it's also important to realize how it was a shifting of the goalposts in the discussion. Measure 110 was not passed with the voters by advocates saying, things are going to go to hell, but this won't be the main reason things go to hell. It was passed on the promise, this is going to make things dramatically better.
Sure. that's how public policy works, right?
And so shifting to, well, you can't definitively prove that things have gone to hell just because of this law. That's not a defense of the law. That also wasn't the promise that was made. So it's not what people voted for. They voted for things to get better.
But do people in your general community, the professors who study this, do they look at that report and say something like, well, he got it wrong? Or do they say something like, poor bastard, the number was right and he wound up just getting embarrassed by the results?
No, I think it was a respected study using, you know, reasonable methods, you know, thoughtful and all that. And that expressed, you know, what things were at 1 year on one measure of drug overdoses. You know, I said a different study, different methods came up with a different answer. But no, I think that is a respected piece of work. So I would presume.
Will someone include the second year's worth of data?
That's a great question to which I do not know the answer.
Well, how could you not? The field demand it?
You know, there's a challenge here, which is, you know, that many of the people who study these things have very strong views about them. And so whether they would want to lift up that rock, I'm not entirely sure.
Right.
You know, particularly now that the repeal presuming the governor signs it, the legislature overwhelmingly, you know, asked for repeal, it may just seem like, well, that's a moot point because the policy is gone.
Yeah. You don't go looking for things you don't want to find. If you had to take the lessons of Oregon, which you were telling us about before they even came to pass in the most horrific ways, but if you were to take the lessons learned and craft a more workable drug policy, which included elements perhaps of intervention, decriminalization, destigmatization, etc., what would you come up with?
Okay, so talking about first a point about racial justice and then a point about the services. There's been a lot of effort, and I think a good motivated effort, to try to create a more racially just country since the murder of George Floyd. And that was present in a lot of the arguments about Measure 110. However, the polling showed, taken just before the legislature voted, that the groups who were the most in favor of repeal were African-American and Hispanics in Oregon. And so this is, again, like Defund the Police, a policy pushed by mainly by white progressives who went to college and allegedly on behalf of groups who were against it. And so if you pursue racial justice, that's a very important thing to pursue, but you have to listen to the BIPOC community and make sure you are pushing things they are truly behind rather than using their name and their struggles as an excuse for your vision of a policy. That's the first thing. It applies not just this, but everything. In terms of what we need what Oregon was like before Measure 110 combined with a good treatment system. They had half of it right. They were using the criminal justice system wisely. They were not throwing people in prison simply for the act of having a drug. They were trying to keep as many people out of jail as possible. And when someone was facing a jail term, which, by the way, would not be just because you were using a drug, but because you push some person over and grab their phone and their purse, or you broke into a house or something. I mean, crimes. That's what most most arrests are around. Not for the drug use, around the crimes. They use that to say, okay, look, Keith, you've done this thing. Normally we would send you to jail, but we're going to give you a choice. You know, you can be in a drug court. You can get into treatment. If you can change your behavior, you don't have to serve that sentence, and we'll expunge that sentence. That is all sensible. Where Oregon fell short and where we need to build up is there have to be good services available for everybody, both for those people who do voluntarily come in, not through the criminal justice system, and for people who have threatened public safety in some way, and we want to do something other than incarcerate them. There has to be services for them as well. It's those two things together. If Oregon can make this work with the new investments in treatment, I think they're going to be a model for the country in the way that Measure 110 proponents hoped they would be, but was now a negative model. It's like, oh my God, I don't want to be like Oregon. But they could become that because they have the criminal justice side right. They just need to get the health side right.
You mentioned you volunteer in San Francisco with the Franciscans. My question is why, and I can imagine a number of reasons, such as it's good to do good works, but does it have something to do with your day job being in more in the realm of abstraction with this group of people and actually working with them in the realm of the concrete?
The reason I wanted to work with the Franciscans at their foundation is, first off, they were nice enough to ask me. They wanted to help make their services better, and they knew that's something I focus on, so I was flattered by that. But I'm very lucky to be at Stanford University. I'm a kid from West Virginia. I never expected to be here. I'm at a university with an endowment that is bigger than, you know, some country's wealth, where there are Nobel Prize winners and millionaires and amazing scientists, and it's incredible. I'm very blessed to be here. And at the same time, that's not real life. You know, in the real world, there are tons of people struggling, and we have an obligation to help the least of these. And that is a place I thought I could keep that part of my spirit alive and keep that commitment alive in a way that's hard to do in a place of a beauty and privilege like Stanford, California.
Mm. So the work that you do, is it consulting, or might we show up on a Thursday and see Keith Humphreys, you know, ladling out soup or sitting with someone who needs their socks darned and they wouldn't even know they're sitting next to one of the preeminent scholars in the field?
Well, I have served soup and happy to do it. The main things I've helped with are they run mental health and substance use services. So I help them with some things you try to do generally, like keep track of where everybody is, see who's getting better, developing systems where we could see what services are working, what services are not. And then we've also done some work with the philanthropists on some new services we'd like to build, like some sober housing, like some things to help people come in directly off the street. So it's been very gratifying, and I feel very grateful that I've gotten to do that.
Do you think your field has made great strides since you've been in it? And do we see, maybe I'm wrong, maybe we as a society had much higher levels of addiction when you started, or maybe that's not the right metric. You know, we're dealing with such more pernicious drugs that you can't just measure how many people lives are negatively impacted by drug use.
So, you know, it's kind of, you know, medicine has made huge strides in general, but population health is worse in a lot of things. So, you know, I recognize like the field is just one input into human health. In the area of addiction, you know, the care of people who have a problem with alcohol or opioids is dramatically better. You know, we have dramatically better treatments. We have medications. We have some interesting, you know, brain stimulation technologies that seem to work. But I'd say the big disappointment of my career, which I started on during the crack cocaine epidemic in the Lower East Side of Detroit at the height of it, is that if you are addicted to a stimulant like crack, like methamphetamine, you could walk into a treatment program today and it would not look different than what I saw back in the late 80s. There has been really no progress in that area. And I find that embarrassing and upsetting, that we can't seem to do better by that particular population of drug users. We've spent billions and billions, government and the private sector, on medications. Nothing has panned out. We don't have a single FDA-approved medication. We have a single behavioral treatment called contingency management that works, and everything else It's just not very effective. And so more or less, to the extent people get better, it's usually not through the treatment system. It's through other changes in their life that you know, we hope get them on a different path.
Have other classes of drugs besides stimulants seen more effective treatments and outcomes?
Yeah. So, you know, there's multiple medications now for alcohol. There's a drug called acamprosate or called naltrexone. We have an older drug called disulfiram. On the opiate side, there's naltrexone, and then there's which is a blocking agent. There's buprenorphine, there's methadone, which are substitution agents. And there's also the rescue medication. So, you know, we have the ability when someone is an overdose to, you know, give them an what's called an antagonist. And I think naloxone is the one everybody knows. It's amazing. It's like a miracle. Those folks would have died. And it's getting that, what has been really good in this latest incarnation of our opioid epidemic is not development of naloxone, because we had naloxone a long time ago, but you just had it in the hospital.
Right.
The fact that, you know, I bet if I'm walking through the tenderloin and I just, you know, said, raise your hand if you got naloxone, there would be social workers, there'd be people, there would be people who use drugs, there would be some cops, and there would be me, who all had this. And that accounts for why, you know, it's an estimate something like 500,000 overdoses have been reversed with naloxone. It was getting it out of the hospital and into communities. And I have to say, for a small bit of vanity, the first endorsement of doing that in a White House drug strategy was under President Obama, and I wrote it when I worked for President Obama.
Yeah.
And I remember when I circulated, people said, you know, like, what is that? And now I'm just glad, like, my kids know what naloxone is. It's on everybody's lips. So.
I just have one more question, which is that I often hear it blamed on just the shambles that the United States healthcare system is under. That's one of the reasons why it's so hard to treat anyone, to give people treatment. That's why relapse rates are so high. But are other countries, I sometimes wonder about that. I have done a little bit of studying about other countries, and some countries don't have this opioid problem like in Europe. I think Scotland does, but very few other countries do. I don't know. It might be for a number of reasons, including who's supplying the drugs. But are other countries with better or different, or at least nationally funded healthcare systems, much better on some of these metrics that we're talking about?
So to answer that, you have to look at what they do and what they don't do. So start with what they don't do. The U.S. and Canada, both through their healthcare system, generated opioid epidemics. You know, 400% increase in prescribing in about 15 years, and that's where a lot of this started. No other countries have done that, thank goodness. You don't see all the iatrogenic opioid cases that we had here in Western Europe, in Australia, or certainly not in developing countries. The access to care is better in countries that have universal health care. And we are the one holdout in that, you know, in the developed world. The fact that there are still people, even though we have improved health insurance, we've got, you know, Affordable Care Act, we have Medicaid has grown and all that. Nonetheless, you don't see in those countries someone who's addicted who just can't get any care at all because they don't have insurance. They do that better than us. And they often do better at getting community practitioners involved. So the example that is cited a lot is France. France had a heroin crisis. Now it's about 20 years ago. And they just said, instead of having buprenorphine specialists, buprenorphine being a, you know, medication specialized for opioids, we're going to just say every single primary care doctor in France can prescribe this right now and should be prescribing it right now. And they did that, and they had an enormous drop in heroin use and heroin arrest. That's the kind of thing we don't have. People who care about addicted patients are a brave, noble, but very small band within medicine. The average primary care doc doesn't really know how to do that and often doesn't want to do that.
Keith, and by the way, iatrogenic is a disease that is caused by treatment.
Correct, yes.
From the etymology of the Greek word for doctor, I believe.
Very
the
good.
Origin is the ivikos, the iatros. I think that's it.
This is an elevated show.
I try to throw the etymology at you. Keith Humphreys is a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford. His latest book is Addiction, A Very Short Introduction. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Mike.
This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel. In 1864, Arizona was still 48 years away from becoming a state. In 1864, the capital of Arizona had moved from Fort Whipple to Prescott. In 1864, the boundaries of the Arizona Territory, established the year prior, included present-day Las Vegas, Nevada. Despite the large size in 1864, the population of the Arizona Territory was under 10,000. I think it was well under 10,000. What we have to go on is the 1860 census, where Arizona was but a county of the New Mexico Territory. And that county had 2,421 white people, 21 free colored people, their designation not mine, 4,040 Indians. The census did not include a count of Arizona's half-breed population, again, their designation, not mine, though they did provide the half-breed numbers for Santa Fe and Valencia counties. Despite its small size and nascent status, the good people, or at least the people of Arizona, did pass a law utilizing all the most advanced states of science available to them, which was, of course, 64 years before the discovery of antibiotics, 1864 being the same year that Joseph Lister was introduced to Louis Pasteur's germ theory of disease and lit upon the idea of sterilization for surgery. So today, the Arizona Supreme Court reached back into time to tease out what was then state-of-the-art thinking on the issue of abortion circa 1864. And they did declare,
in a historic ruling just handed down from the Arizona Supreme Court on abortion access in our state, we just got our hands on that official opinion, the justices ruling to reinstate a near total ban on abortions in a law that was created back in 1864 before Arizona was a state. The law does allow for exceptions, but only if a woman's life is in danger. That is the only exception in this law.
Arizona has seven members on their Supreme Court, six voted. It is nominally a nonpartisan process to nominate people to the Supreme Court. Then the governor appoints, and then there are retention elections. Almost always does a standing justice win election in a retention election, often overwhelmingly. All seven were appointed by Republican governors, which doesn't necessarily mean they decide cases as Republicans, but there are rating systems which look at that and look at the past public stances of the people on the court. And indeed, six of the seven are rated as either mildly or strongly Republican. One is rated as indeterminate. It should also be noted that the member of the court who recused himself did run for office, Attorney General, as a Republican, and has called Planned Parenthood the source of generational genocide. Now, legal scholars say that there is some justification in the ruling. The law, the anti-abortion law from 1864, was codified after Arizona became a territory, and again the year after Arizona became a state, state 1912, law codified 1913. The court did issue a stay, so lower courts can hash out some details. And this means that a woman with an abortion scheduled next week in Arizona can still get an abortion next week in Arizona, in all likelihood. Even Republican Senate candidate Kari Lake does not support the total ban on abortion. Well, she doesn't as a political matter. She says that's not her political stance. But before the 1864 law was officially recognized as Arizona's law, she endorsed it. Now she says she would vote against a federal total ban on abortion. Luckily for her, it's now a state's issue, her state's issue. And if she endorses Donald Trump's guidebook for how national Republicans should deal with the issue, she will distance herself from it and say that's not really on my plate this time around. Arizona's Attorney General Chris Mays, a Democrat, said right after the ruling came down that her office will not enforce the law, but that doesn't mean local law enforcement officers can't try. Of the states that Arizona borders, California and New Mexico have no legal restrictions on abortion. Utah has an 18-week ban, which of course means that poor residents living perhaps on a Native American reservation in Arizona might have to drive up to 5 hours just to reach a neighboring state border, and then perhaps many hours into that to find an abortion clinic. Such is the consequence of deferring to the state of the art, the state of science, and the state of lawmaking in 1864. That's it for today's show. Corey Wara produces The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca spearheads special projects for Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oopru, gpru, doopru. Thanks for listening.